I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Hello Animal Talks, where I am connecting you with people around the world who are working for animal welfare. And today, I'm very excited to have Brian Sharp, who is the Director of Marine and Mammal Rescue and Research for the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And Brian oversees international response and training for the rescue of marine animals. I believe you have 200 volunteers that help you out. And you're one of the few people who's permitted to disentangle whales in American waters. And I'm just really excited to hear about the work that you're doing, because I know that, you know, it's a big job. So welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on today, Jenny. And looking forward to it.
Tell me how you got into this in the first place.
And so my path into this field actually came, I was an animal science major. So I went to school in Southwest Virginia, Virginia Tech, and was animal science. So I dealt with mostly terrestrial livestock in my schooling. Through that, developed an interest in marine programs, grew up in Delaware. So, you know, was, you know, as a young child, you know, my parents would go out in boats and out in Delaware Bay and out in the ocean. And so that's where it started. And then have that amazing opportunity to be able to combine those two. Worked in Florida for several years. Eventually the Florida heat got a little too warm. So I, back in the early 2000s, came up to Massachusetts, to do stranding work. And part of what brought me here to, I'm based in southeastern Massachusetts on Cape Cod, is it's actually the busiest place anywhere in the world for dolphin strandings. So we have dolphins strand here more frequently than any location in the world. And it's also the location where we have most mass strandings. So that's a stranding of two or more dolphins. Obviously, there's a huge time-sensitive component of that. And dolphins are stranded and are on land when the tides recede. So it was just an amazing opportunity for me. So I'm lucky that I was able to get that.
Why is that such an issue there?
Part of it is how the Cape Cod, so we're specifically on in southeastern Massachusetts, out on a, it's basically a peninsula that sticks out in the ocean, sandy peninsula. Part of it is our geography. We have very high tide flux, so the tide will rise and fall every 6 hours, 10 to 12 feet. Our bathymetry, or underwater geography, sand flats, mud flats, some places, when the tide goes out every 6 hours, an additional mile of beach is uncovered. So you can imagine a group of dolphins that are foraging for food in 6-8 waters, in 6-8 feet of water. Suddenly, an hour or two later, they're high and dry and could be a half mile or more from open water. So, yeah. And Cape Cod is unique in that way. There are a couple other locations around the world, specifically New Zealand, the South Island of New Zealand, a place called Farewell Spit, which if you take the area where we live, Cape Cod, and invert it, turn it upside down, it basically looks like Farewell Spit in New Zealand. So There's a couple of locations in the world that have similarities to us in geography that see mass strandings like this of dolphins.
It's kind of funny. Like, I think immediately they're such smart animals. Have they not heard from previous stranded animals that have been saved to sort of be aware of the changing tides?
That's a great question. And when people ask that, I let them know that when we're out on the water, we see a lot of people in vessels with depth sounders and fancy GPS also run aground. So, but you can imagine, and also, you know, realizing that this area changes, sandbars develop, and that's that is a normal course of the geography in this area, you know, because we are a sandy peninsula. One storm can create a sandbar. Dolphins are hunting fish on the other side of that sandbar. Water starts to drop. Suddenly, what we think is they then have to go through that, you can imagine, very uncomfortable decision of, I have to go through shallow water to get to that deep water. And so that can force animals into these pockets, which right. then causes the strandings. And that's when the clock really starts ticking. So that's where you mentioned earlier about our volunteer network. And that's where this started. It was people on Cape Cod seeing an animal welfare need, seeing stranded animals and wanting to find solutions, knowing that more can be done, things can be done better. And that's how our agency started, doing stranding response in this area, people coming together and learning. And in the over 22 years, we started this stranding network here on Cape Cod in 1998. And so it's 23 years now. And so in that time, it's amazing to see where it's grown and been able to develop and learn from every stranding, live animals as well as dead animals, a good portion of our time. And I always tell this to when young students are interested in coming into this field, is there's a lot to be learned from dead animals. It's not just the live animals, because that there's a Latin term, vivos mortui docens, says the dead teach the living. And that is the mantra of our necropsy program, is using that information so that from even dead animals to help make each live animal response that much better, provide those animals better treatment, provide them better care, supportive care, so that way it increases their chances for survival.
Right. So when you're looking at a dead animal, you're sort of evaluating what caused their death so that you can get to that issue in a timely fashion when you're rescuing, trying to get somebody out alive.
Yep, exactly. And it also gives us this amazing opportunity. Stranding response anywhere in the world gives us this amazing opportunity to monitor the health of the oceans. Because marine mammals, seals, dolphins, whales, they're at the top of their, can't say food chain anymore. I guess that's what we used when we were in school. And now we know it's much more complex than the food web. But they are central components to that food web, and they're feeding on a trophic level or a food resource level that's similar to ours. So it's a great opportunity for us to not only provide aid to individual animals, but to keep and monitor that ocean health. Things just changes. In just my 18 years that I've been here on Cape Cod, we're seeing changes in species. We're seeing animals shifting. And when I talk to fishermen, they see the same. And a lot of this is due to the change in the environment, the water temperature. The water temperature in the Gulf of Maine, which is the large body of water to the north of us, is one of the fastest warming bodies of water anywhere in the world due to its depth. And so we're seeing those changes. So that's incredibly important information. So we learn from the individuals to be able to help other individuals, but then it's also that ocean health that gives us a great, amazing snapshot. The other component of it is to see where human impacts or anthropogenic impacts on the environment, so things like entanglement of fishing gear, vessel strikes, are all important things for us to monitor. And so those dead animal investigations, those necropsies, are incredibly important.
It's a lot that they're having to deal with in the oceans now, these animals that are trying to stay alive and have good lives. Can you sort of equate what these animals are dealing with in the oceans on a human level? Like if you're in your neighborhood and you're walking down the sidewalk and you have all these different obstacles you have to navigate in order to get from A to B. Do you have like an equivalent? Because I know the nets are like in the way, and there's so much noise, they can't communicate with each other.
Yep. And that's, you know, and the best, especially let's take one particular kind of entanglement, we deal with cases of large whales and other marine mammals get entangled in fishing gear. And I get the question a lot of time is, well, these are smart animals. They're able to perceive their environment. Why aren't they avoiding this? And the best analogy I can come up with is we have conservation land not too far away. So it's a great place for me to take my dog for a walk in the morning. Imagine, you know, if as you're walking through the woods, or, you know, if you've done that before, you'll hit inevitably, especially in the morning before anyone else has been on that trail, you'll hit spider webs that have come up through the night. Now imagine if those spider webs that you can't really see well when you're walking along the path, at least to my dog's walking through. Imagine if every time I hit one of those, it put me in a life-threatening situation. That's an incredibly, and that if you kind of scale it on a size factor, that's what these animals are dealing with. You know, they're in the oceans trying to make a living, you know, trying to migrate, forage for food, breed, support calves, and then to add obstacles in the way that are very hard to detect. And also, they don't necessarily know the lethality of that. You know, that line looks small, but we know that any line in the ocean can cause a life-threatening entanglement to anything from a seal all the way up to a North Atlantic right whale.
And the boats are an issue too, like boats in the waterway hitting these animals.
Vessel strikes are definitely something that we're always concerned about for all species of marine mammals, from the smallest to the largest, but especially with large whales. A great example is the North Atlantic right whale that migrates up and down the east coast of the United States from the breeding grounds off of Florida, Georgia, up to feeding in the springtime here around Cape Cod. And then right now they're heading up and arriving in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada to those northern areas. And so as they're traveling that area, they're traveling one of the most populated place in the U.S. and one of the busiest areas for marine activity in the world. And so it is navigating that area that is incredibly difficult. And vessel strikes, a lot of times people think it's just ships, but it's any vessel. If you have, a private vessel that is traveling fast, that can also cause an incredible amount of damage, not only to the whale, but there's also a huge human safety factor from that as well. I mean, imagine, traveling 40 miles an hour in a vessel and then suddenly coming to a stop because you've hit something that weighs 30 tons that is underwater. I mean, it's basically like hitting an iceberg.
I know that was a big problem with the manatees in Florida, wasn't it?
Yep. And my previous part of my career, I actually worked for Florida Fish and Wildlife as a manatee biologist. And you're absolutely right. That's how manatees were identified. Us with our fingerprints, manatees would be identified by previous propeller marks, which when you think about it, is really incredible that you see human scars on an animal that are that prevalent that becomes their ID factor.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable.
And we see that with large whales as well. Over 80% in most species that we see, over 80% of the large whales, humpbacks, right whales, have scars from entangling in fishing gear. And that, unfortunately, is one of the ways that these animals are identified, is from these anthropogenic or human-caused interactions.
Now, so let's imagine a whale swimming into a fishing net. So you kind of picture it as his nose is going in first, and then the net is sort of dragging behind him. Tell us how they get really tangled up and what the consequences of that are for them?
No, that's a great question. And while nets are of a huge concern, any line that's in the water. So right now, any trap or pot that's used to fish is connected to a line called a buoy line that goes up to the buoy. Buoy serves several purposes. It marks where the gear is. It allows the fisher to be able to pull up on that to collect the gear. And that's where we see a lot of the entanglements in whales is through those buoy lines. So as the animal's swimming through the water, you know, you've got the animal itself, you've got its mouth open. If it's feeding, you've got these incredibly large pectoral flippers that are, you know, larger than a garage door out on either side that they're using to be able to navigate and steer through this massive tail that they're using to propel this 20 to 30 ton animal through the water. Those are all points that what seems like simple line can hit. And just like any other animal, just like us, if I hit some of the spider web example, right. If I do that, what do? I roll away from it. And that is the start of an entanglement. And that's how entanglements progress, is as that animal hits that line, the animal rolls away, which means other body parts get involved. The animal starts to thrash, and that's how the entanglements progress. For some animals, they're able to break that cure because they're so strong. That doesn't mean they're out of danger, because that still means that there is that line that is wrapping body parts is on them. So they're not out of danger, and it's still a life-threatening situation. And now for rescue teams, that makes it even harder, because then they have to locate and try to rescue that animal while it's moving. For other species, such as the smaller of the large whales, minkes, they don't have the strength to break that gear, break that line. And so now they're anchored to the bottom. The animal's not able to make it to the surface to breathe. These are all marine mammals. They need to make it to the surface to be able to breathe. If they are able to make it to the surface to breathe, they probably won't be able to pull that gear or move. And so that's when they need to intervention or rescue teams to proceed. For other species like seals, we see a lot of entangled seals with, you mentioned netting, monofilament netting around their necks that creates this deadly necklace of gear around their necks. And as those animals are feeding, and as they're trying to, because this is the time of year where they're coming off of breeding pupping season, and now females, they're trying to put on weight because they need to recover and they need to grow. But the problem is you have this deadly necklace of gear that's around their necks.
And I imagine like it can wrap around their mouths, and it can wrap around their, like for the finned animals, it can wrap around their fins and drag, like you say, wrap around their tails, maybe drag them down so they can't get up. How do you even know? Is this all, do you find out about these animals purely by people happening to be in an area where they see something going on? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And so much of this is reaching out to the general public, the boating communities. We get reports from people walking on a beach who are sharp-eyed and see an animal near shore towing gear. But stranding networks and disentanglement networks throughout the U.S., that's what we rely on, is the general public seeing something and then calling it in and reporting it.
Right.
And sometimes people don't know that there is someone to call. And so they make the right decision to call their natural resources officer or their police department or their fire department in some cases. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of work to reach out to those agencies so that they know they can call us. We have the training, the equipment, and can respond quickly. The entire United States is actually broken up geographically for marine animal response. The 1972 Marine Animal Protection Act mandated that NOAA fisheries study and respond to live and dead marine mammals. the federal government doesn't have the capacity to cover that incredibly large area. So what happens is the federal government issues permits to do this work because marine mammals are protected.
Right.
Federal government issues permits. And so agencies like ours, academic agencies, universities, state agencies have these permits. And so the entire coastline of the U.S. is broken up. And so we do that work for the animals, but also to help the federal government with that mandate that they have to respond to these and collect information and find out what is affecting the animals and what changes are we seeing in the ocean.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. Since I was young, I mean, I can imagine that the impetus to take care of these animals has changed so much. People are much more responsive to this kind of work, which is really great.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as we've learned more and there are more eyes out and people know, and again, it's just like this. It's letting people know what problems exist and letting them know that there is someone to contact. So that way you can get that report, because there is, I can say this having worked in the field for an incredibly long time, there is no worse feeling than finding out a day or two afterwards that someone saw something, but they didn't know to report it. And that is, there's really no the worst feeling of helplessness. And then we're just relying on, hopefully that animal is seen again, and then that person reports. So that is one of the things that we always ask people, is that if you see something, report it.
Well, I can imagine that since it's all reliant on people observing and reporting, that there are a ton of animals that aren't getting help at all that we don't even know about.
Right. And there's been some great work to look at that, to try to figure out what the impacts are, such as right whales, for example. You know, there's a recent scientific publication that came out showing that only, you know, a half to a third of the deaths that we know about, that there are actually 2 to 3 times the number of mortalities or deaths of right whales than what we know about, because we know not everything gets seen. The ocean's very big. And again, if someone sees it, they may not know what they're seeing. You know, it may be an animal that died and is decomposed. They might not even recognize it as a dead whale. And then also people, again, just not knowing that there is someone to call, and that information is so important to helping other live animals, but also to help make management decisions. So that way, state agencies, federal agencies have that information. The industries themselves, fishing industry, shipping industry, so that they can make changes so that animals are not as affected, but also that they can still make a living doing their jobs and doing their professions. So it's that very critical piece, finding that balance.
Yeah. So when you come across a stranded animal, or when a stranded animal is reported, what's the time frame to rescue that animal? I'm sure it depends on the animal itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, elaborate on that a little bit.
It depends on where the animal is, and it depends on where the closest stranding network response team is. You know, here on Cape Cod, we're fortunate that our stranding coverage area is Cape Cod down to the Massachusetts Rhode Island border. When you look at it, that's not a long amount of coastline, but because we have such a high frequency of events in this place, so it depending on where it is in our coverage area, response times vary. And as you said, it, you know, whether the animal is accessible or not. One of the first things we do is we will get one of our volunteers out. So we have mentioned that this entire stranding team started as a grassroots effort. We still, you know, that's still our foundation, that volunteer-based people from the community that we train act as our eyes and ears. So that's where our folks call. We have a special little system that we use to alert people when we set a geographic boundary. And the first volunteer that calls back and responds to say, yep, I'm available, I can get out there. There are eyes and ears. So, you know, we aim to try to minimize that as much as possible, because in some cases, it might be a seal that is perfectly fine, resting on the beach, young animal. And we just need to be able to assess from a safe distance and let people know, if people are walking or running their dogs on the beach, say, just so you know, there's a seal over there, could put your dog on a leash, the seal's safety, as well as the dog's safety. And so that's what we go for. And, in the cases with stranded dolphins, getting a volunteer out there to know, so that we know size of the animal, species of the animal, location, are they alive or dead? And so that changes each response. So we try to do it as fast as possible, but we try to have a trained set of eyes out there as quickly as possible, because the more information we have, the better the response we can perform.
Right. So, what's a typical time that a dolphin can spend out of water?
That's also a very good question. The interesting things about cetaceans, and all dolphins, whales, are all types of cetacean, the larger you are, the harder time you have outside of water. You're basically, evolutionarily, the way you got that big was because you are supported by the water. Points is incredibly important. The smaller you are, the better formed you are at being able to support your body.
Right.
So we tend to see this, the harbor porpoise is the smallest of the cetaceans that we see. They tend to suffer less effects, generally speaking, from the stranding itself. Now, we do always, when we are treating and transporting animals to a deep water release site, we have them, we're starting supportive care, we're trying to adjust their temperature, we have them on padded mats so that it's distributing the weight. We always try to make this time from rescue, from the stranded beach to release, as short as possible. And during that time, trying to make sure they're as comfortable. So assigning a time to it changes with every animal, but on the order of, and realize some of these stranded dolphins may have been stranded, we know from where they are on the tide line, may have been stranded for 2 to 3 hours before someone happens to be on that part of the beach. They can survive out of the water. They don't need to be in the water to survive. It's more thermoregulation and to distribute that body mass there. So,
right.
As long as that's being taken care of, it can be several hours until they get released. But again, we try to minimize that as much as possible. Being out of the water, especially getting in the summertime, luckily our busiest time of year for dolphin strandings in this area is December through April. Not kind to our stranding responders because it's some of the worst weather New England has to offer.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's better for, in a big way, it's better for the dolphins because the temperatures are less. The temperature is lower. That plays into, that helps them because they start overheating incredibly rapidly,
right,
because of their blubber layer, because of their insulation. And just sun exposure. We do occasionally have strandings that occur during the summertime. This past August, we had 45 dolphins that stranded in one stranding. That is not the phone call that we ever want to get, but the team reacted incredibly fast, volunteers out there. It was all hands on deck. Everybody came in for that response. An incredible, every volunteer that we could reach because we needed all hands for that. But because dolphins, they don't need that protection from the sun because they're in the water, they succumb to the effects of sun exposure incredibly quickly. And so the volunteers, in addition to getting eyes on the animals, they'll take sheets, wet the sheets, and apply them to the dolphin, make sure they stay clear of the blowhole.
Right.
But that way it does a couple of things. It cools the dolphin. It also helps give a block from that incredibly intense sun exposure, because these animals, because their skin is novel to being exposed to the sun, blistering can occur within minutes.
Right.
Really incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Intense sunburn.
Yeah.
And so, okay. So just to clarify, when you're talking about the size of the animal being on land, basically their weight is crushing them when they don't have the buoyancy of the water.
Yep. Yeah. In simplest terms. Yeah, exactly.
It's incredible. Really is. It's incredible. So do you all do any like oil spill cleanups or do you deal with the illegal hunting trade or anything like that?
So for oil spill, the most recent, and hopefully this is the case, the most recent one we had is actually just when I started back in 2003, there was a oil spill in Buzzards Bay. Mm-hmm. And so we responded to that, and we were fortunate in that the time of year that that occurred, there were not a lot of seals present. So we were very fortunate that we had some dead animals that were found on the beach during the cleanup efforts that had been boiled, but there were none that were found to be direct causes of that event, thankfully. But we always maintain our readiness for that and to help with other agencies through that area. And I missed the second part of your question.
Yeah, the second part was like the illegal hunting and trading. You know, I know the shark fin industry is a huge problem. And so much of it is just, you know, I feel like it's based on a misunderstanding of the animals and their nature. Where people are like, well, it's just a shark and they're just killing machines and who cares about whether they're being decimated, you know?
Right. And so my team's work deals with marine mammals specifically, but larger IFAL, we do have a program that deals with wildlife trade for those, you know, those very things, right. Both illegal and then also, you know, other types of wildlife trade to work with those challenges throughout the world. And so that's actually one of the great things about working for an agency like IFAL is our work happens locally, but using that information to affect change globally. We have offices in 15 countries around the world and projects in 42 countries. And so it allows it. It's that ability to learn and then expand that knowledge. And it's part of the reason why was lucky enough to come work for IFAL.
Yeah. So much information being shared. Mm-hmm. So do you yourself, like, do you do marine mammal rescues in other countries, or you're pretty much set right there in your area? Because it sounds like you're super busy in your area.
We are super busy. We do have a international component of our program. So that's twofold. We'll bring individuals in, but then we will also, either through consultations and over this past during the pandemic, obviously things had to occur more through virtual and phone consultations with other areas. And sometimes these events happen so quickly, that's the only way to deal with it. Other times, if the event is more prolonged, yes, we will absolutely send individual or staff members out to help guide local resources, act as a resource, to help teams with the rescues themselves. And so that's one of the really great parts of this program is that international component, is being able to have that involved and really seeing that learning spread quickly.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be quite a challenge with countries that have traditionally lived off of these animals in the ocean as part of a giant trade that they do with the whaling and the, you know, harp seal hunting and things like that, convincing them to go a different route.
Yeah, and that's, it's one of those things that, you know, you definitely want to look at, and times change, people's resource needs change. I mean, let's look at the history right here. Back in the 1800s, a mass stranding of pilot whales on Cape Cod, people would have seen that as a food resource. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, a few hundred years later, we see that as an animal welfare need that needs to be filled, and that as an opportunity to be able to learn from that. So over time, people's perceptions, their relationships to animals have most definitely changed, even just in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible.
As mentioned.
Yeah. One of the things I think that has changed over time is this idea of rescuing an animal and then releasing them instead of rescuing them and keeping them in captivity. Mm. There, I I think there used to be a perception that once you caught them and took care of them, that they would no longer be able to go back out. And that's a new way of thinking, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you know, we face that as well with our stranded dolphins. In the early 2000s, the 90s and the early 2000s, it was thought that dolphins that strand by themselves couldn't be released. We saw upon necropsy that we were not necessarily in all single-stranded animals, finding any signs of disease or injury that was different from mass-stranded animals. And so we challenged that thinking that these single-stranded animals could be released. And luckily, technology caught up with us. So in 2010, the technology to be able to temporarily satellite tag a dolphin got so small that we could do with a very quick procedure that's actually very similar to ear piercing, attach a temporary satellite tag to the trailing edge of the dolphin's dorsal fin. And when we went to our permitting agency at the federal government, NOAA Fisheries, and said, you know, we believe that these animals can survive, that these single-stranded animals can survive, thrive, and assimilate back into a pod of the same species, conspecifics. And they said, well, you know, with this satellite tag, we can prove that. And so we can answer that question. And that's exactly what we were able to do. Just even as recently as this past March and April, where our stranding season for dolphins was very condensed this year, for whatever reason, we're not clear. But we had several cases where we had single-stranded animals that stranded days behind mass strandings of animals. And through those satellite tags, we were able to see those animals meet up. And that was that dogma or perception that people had, was that belief that these single animals can't be released because they're sick, they're injured. If they do find a pod, they'll just bring that pod in. All of these misconceptions that we were able to show that as long as these dolphins are assessed as healthy, we treat them, we get them back to the water, that just showing that success. So it is kind of one of the amazing things that technology finally got to the point where we could answer the questions we've been asking for a while.
Yeah. Sometimes you hear about people saying that these stranded animals are stranding themselves on purpose. Is that something you all have been able to prove or disprove? Is that like they're committing suicide or something?
We have, that would be a very difficult thing to prove, and as equally hard to disprove. We can only look at what we see in our examinations of those animals that do die. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have animals, I do always want to make sure that people realize that while, especially here on Cape Cod, we have animals that strand due to the tides and due to chasing prey that we talked about earlier, we do see animals that are sick or injured, and we do not want those animals to endure any more suffering than they already have. So we do want to do the responsible things. And that does involve euthanasia. And that is, you can imagine, is one of the toughest parts, the toughest part of this job. But yeah, I everything that we've seen with strandings, you know, is linked. And you know, again, as we've shown with our post-release monitoring, there's temporary satellite tag. If those animals are taken out of that imminent danger they have of stranding, those animals are surviving and thriving. And so I would think that would disprove any theories on that.
Do you have a favorite incident or episode of rescuing?
That's a good question. Oh, it's kind of hard to parse out individual ones over the years. I think one of my favorite is about 2015 or 2016. We had a minke whale that stranded in an area where we see a lot of our dolphin strandings. And so this was a 22-foot animal that stranded. The tide was rushing in. Volunteers got out. But the animal was high and dry, and the tide started coming in incredibly fast. And again, with large whales, the popular notion is like, nope, you know, something must be wrong with them. You know, that And so we looked at it, we're like, all right, prove to us whether you're healthy or not healthy. And so we went, did our procedure that we do for when dolphins train. Veterinarian did a health assessment, took a small sample of blood that we could actually have blood analyzers that are part of our mobile dolphin rescue clinic that we can run those blood amounts. It's like a, basically think of it as a mobile vet clinic. And everything we were finding was that, all right, this animal seems like it's in good shape. So was this animal just in the wrong place at the wrong time, when the time dropped out? So we used one of those temporary dolphin satellite tags and were able to attach it to the trailing edge of the minke whale. As the tide rushed in, we used inflatable lifting bags to lift the animal up, corral it out, used the harbor master's vessel to coax, kind of like, this is where my training in animal science and dealing with livestock really came in. Is always, in some cases, to get the animals to deep water, we have to herd them like a sheepdog herds a flock of sheep. Yes, exact same principle, so that they can make it out these incredibly complex channels and sand flats to deep water. That's typically where the story ends. But because we were able to attach that satellite tag, we were able to monitor that minke whale for 83 days afterwards until the battery depleted and we lost the transmissions. That minke whale left Cape Cod Bay, swam down just north of the Turks and Caicos, spent time in the Caribbean, which I thought was a wise choice, an area that that we know from other researchers who have hydrophones that minke whales are detected in their area. It's a feeding ground for them. Made its way back up the East Coast. All in all, in the time, about 83 days that we were tracking this minke whale, showing that this animal survived this stranding event, it traveled the equivalent of if you went from London Heathrow to Honolulu, Hawaii. That's the distance that this minke whale traveled in those 83 days going to different locations. And so that was incredible to be able to follow that and see all of that work that we've been doing with dolphins and applying it to a larger animal and seeing the team work together to problem solve that and give that animal another chance.
Amazing. I think we've done a real big disservice to ourselves and animals to completely throw away anthropomorphizing, because we're completely negating what we're seeing with our own eyes and what we're experiencing. And to say that it's not valid because we're putting human characteristics on another species, to me, is taking away a giant part of observation and experience. And it really, I think, does a disservice to everybody. As part of that, like, have you ever had an experience where you have saved an animal and then have seen any kind of display of gratitude or recognition that you have done something for that animal?
That's incredibly hard to discern. And it is, you know, as you said, it's, you know, if we think back, it's not too far in the past where people were debating, do animals have emotions, which when we think about that now, like, you know, anybody who has a dog and cat, like, that is not an argument. And so, you know, to think back that was a discussion that was had years ago is really amazing. The only thing that I do caution people that, because as I've gone through and done rescues, is trying to figure out what animals are feeling. I do think we have to be careful because it in some ways can almost be too simplistic. It's much more complex than that. Their emotions, it's very difficult, you know, with entangled animals. These are animals that have been, you know, carrying these entanglements for days, weeks, months, in the case of some large whales and some pinnipeds. Incredible pain. When we approach as rescuers, I don't know what emotions those animals have. You know, do they see me as a threat? But, you know, I mean, it's not too far back in history that even in this area of the United States, that whales and some of these animals were hunted. So, it's very difficult. It's just whenever people ask, it's just you know, I sometimes have a hard time trying to figure out what the dog is trying to tell me an emotion that she is expressing. So I always ask people to realize that they are incredibly complex. The assigning of emotion or a feeling to an animal is tough. It is really tough because, you know, I don't know what that animal has been through. I can only guess. I mean, I have never carried an entanglement. I've never been, you know, hit by a vessel or anything like that. So, you imagine the confusion of being rushed to a lot of times we use the analogy of a car accident and being disoriented and going into the emergency room. So it's very difficult to say and, you know, incredibly complex.
Yeah. But
I wish I knew.
Yeah. But see, like even all of that, I feel like is so, it's all stuff that we can empathize with. They're vertebrates. They have the same nervous system we do. Their brains are maybe smaller or bigger or whatever, but, we have basically the same nervous system. And it just amazes me. Like you were mentioning the dogs, they are still coming out with articles that are like it's some revelation that a dog will grieve its lost puppy or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think after all these years, this is still something that needs to be proved in a scientific article. And everybody is so surprised. It just amazes me.
Right.
Yeah. And then you think, okay, you have these very intelligent animals in the ocean. Of course, we're basing intelligence on our own measurement of it, which is completely ridiculous.
Right. They are perfectly suited for the environment that they are in. If you ask me to echolocate and there are some people that have been able to adapt uses of sound, especially those that are vision impaired, it is definitely something you can develop, but to the level that marine mammals have developed it, you know, it's intelligence. It's different, you know, I agree that that is the trap that as humans, we try to compare everything back to ourselves. It's an easy thing. It's the thing we're most familiar with. But it really sells things short.
It does. But I also think it's really important because I think we need to understand that these animals are experiencing a lot of the emotions that we have ourselves. They're having experiences that are affecting them in the same ways they would, you know, affect us, losing, you know, grief over a lost calf or terror over being entangled, fear that, you know, is this person coming to help me or are they not?
Right.
Cellular memory of the history of their species, you know, where they instinctively know that they've been hunted for centuries. And, you know, that information comes down through their DNA. And I just think it's a big thing for me. I feel like,
And especially with long-lived animals such as large whales, where you have animals that, you know, bowhead whales have been shown to be over a century old, you know, and so that's, like you said, that memory can lie with individuals as well.
Yeah, that's just one of my pet peeves. is negating the whole anthropomorphizing as valid. And also, you know, it's kind of along the lines of negating anecdotal evidence, because if you think about it, a lot of scientific studies wouldn't be done unless there were enough anecdotes that somebody said, gosh, I seem to be hearing a lot about this. Maybe
that's
I should.
The germination. Yeah, that's the start of a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of a circular thing. Do you have anything like you want to share that we haven't gotten to? Anything?
Oh, gosh. I guess the biggest thing to your viewers is, again, if you're you are lucky enough to live near the ocean, or if you're just visiting, please always, and this is with other animal species as well, is, you know, there is a network of marine mammal responders and wildlife responders all throughout the area. So if you see an animal in need, please contact someone. For the animal's safety and your safety, please contact a professional, because we do want those animals to be taken care of and rescued properly. And so, you know, let people know, you know, it's a great opportunity to affect change and help.
Yeah. International Fund for Animal Welfare takes donations. Is that the best information to put at the end? Is that the animal, the International Fund for Animal Welfare information?
Any traffic to the website, and then our portion of it for my program is IFAL/strandings. That goes through what to look for, who to call. It also has resources of if a person isn't in, for instance, in Maryland, call Maryland DNR, you know, National Aquarium, you know, partners that we work with.
Right. Okay. Well, I just have loved talking to you.
Yes, it's been wonderful.
It's been really great. If anything happens, you know, if anything comes up, any kind of story that you want people to hear about, give me a call and we'll talk about it, and I'll put it out on my series.
No, that sounds great. Yeah. No, it's one of the things that we're trying to promote more, is getting more information out there so that people can follow and see what's going on. It's very easy, because there's so much work to do. Yeah. Sometimes we forget to tell people about that.
Well,
so we always like that opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm totally happy. I feel like, you know, that's something I can easily do for, you know, people that are out in the field doing work like you. And
word out.
Yeah, definitely. One quick question that I forgot. Yeah. Did you notice any kind of difference during COVID, like with the maybe less ocean traffic or less people on the beaches? Did you notice any kind of difference with anything you were doing?
We actually saw more people on the beaches, because that was, I think, a lot of people's way of social distancing was getting on the beaches. So yeah, we actually did see increase in reports because more eyes, you know, here specifically on Cape Cod, we had a lot more people because they could work remotely, were coming and staying on Cape. And so that has increased the reports. So yeah, and it increases reports. It also increases people on the beach. So there's that double edge where we're finding out about things, but then we're also trying to give those animals room. So, you know, social distancing is not just for humans.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that we're doing right now, and actually just started as of this past Memorial Day, is we have signs that have gone up all throughout this region talking about safe wildlife viewing, because while we want people to have that experience, we want people to understand the natural world, respect it, value it. We also don't want to harass animals, juvenile animals that are calling out and need that time to rest, adult animals. And for those animals' safety, and then again, that's our safety as well, and our pets' safety.
Yeah.
And so we're actually getting those signs up and getting those out there. So yeah, it's increased our reports, which has been a good thing, but just, yeah, making sure that people are being responsible with wildlife watching.
It's kind of crazy that you still have to do that. But I remember my husband and I went to Hawaii. We went to snorkeling in an area where they had sea turtles. And of course, they say, stay away from the sea turtles. Do not chase the sea turtles. Give them their space. We jump in the water. And the first thing a whole bunch of people do is go chase the sea turtles.
Yep. We see that a lot of time with seals, juvenile seal, juveniles especially haven't developed that needed an important fear of humans. And so people think, because the animal's letting me approach them, that it must be okay, when we as biologists see that animal going through stress behaviors, eating sand, which is one of the things that can develop infections from eating sand, but it's a stress behavior. Dogs, you know, some of those very subtle signs, like when a dog yawns, sometimes it's a stress reaction. And so being able to pick up on those very minute cues. Just because you can approach an animal doesn't mean that animal is happy with you being.
Right.
Especially with wildlife.
Yeah.
So much to learn.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Well, I just thank you so much for everything you do.
Of course.
Thank you for coming and speaking with me.
Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, I'll look forward to maybe talking to you again, and certainly keep it in mind if you have something that's happening and you want to get the word out.
Okay. It's great meeting you, Jenny.
Thanks, Brian.
Take care. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.